From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we profile two of the Wisconsinites vying to be the Democratic nominee for governor.
First, we hear from candidate Mike McCabe, founder of the government watchdog group Blue Jean Nation.
Then a conversation with candidate Malin Mitchell, president of the Wisconsin Firefighters Union.
Later, our Fit for You segment meets two traveling chefs on a mission.
When we first opened, Miriam was like, don't tell people the food is healthy because they won't want to eat here, you know? So I would tell people that, you know, we never really focused on the health benefits.
Plus, we celebrate International Cat Day by learning about the feline companions that came to the New World with the first European settlers.
It was a one-way trip. So those cats also got off those boats at the same time as those people, and they founded their own feline states of America.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. The gubernatorial primaries are here. In just under a week, voters will head to the polls to pick who will be on the ballot this November. This week, Lake Effect and WUWM News have been profiling the political contenders vying for your vote.
WUWM's Marty Michelson spoke with each of the candidates and asked them this question. If voters were able to spend just a few minutes with you, what would you want them to take away from that conversation?
We've been airing the conversations in alphabetical order. So today we start with candidate Mike McCabe, who has made his career lamenting the boatloads of money spent on elections. McCabe is the founder of the government watchdog group Blue Jean Nation. Marty caught up with McCabe at a candidate forum in Mequon and asked him why he entered the race.
We live at a very dangerous moment right now, I think, for our state and our country. And we've got a political system that has been commandeered by wealthy interests and we got a government that is working for a very few at the top, but is ignoring the wishes and needs of an awful lot of people. There are just so many forgotten people living in forgotten places all around Wisconsin, and they deserve representation, but they don't really have it right now. And you know, my work over the course of most of my adult life has been about trying to expose corruption and the influence of big money in politics. And I really do bring that spirit into the governor's race and hopefully into the governor's office to get our government working for all of us and not just a wealthy and well-connected and privileged few.
What are the top three issues facing Wisconsinites and how do you plan to address them?
I think right at the top is the fact that so far in the 21st century, no state in America has seen its middle class shrink more than Wisconsin. And we've got levels of economic inequality not seen in this state since the Great Depression. So there's so many people out there who can find work, but they're having a devil of a time finding work that enables them to stay in the middle class. They're having a hard time keeping their heads above water. So we've had an approach in Wisconsin to economic development that's been all about feeding the rich and showering tax breaks and state subsidies on a few at the top in hopes that some of what they're given will filter down to the rest of us. But we've got to do an about-face and build a sturdy economy from the bottom up and work on using our state's resources to empower regular working people, empower close to 6 million people in the state to do more for themselves and for each other. And that's right at the top of the list of what we have to do. But to do that, we're going to have a government that is free to lead in that direction and is not simply beholden to wealthy interests and is not simply taking cues from a tiny segment of society that makes these huge donations to elected officials and then expects favors in return. So, you know, that's a huge challenge is to get our economy benefiting everybody. We've got to have a government that works for all of us and not just a privileged few. Healthcare access, people are afraid to get sick and they're worried about being able to go to the doctor if they do get sick. Affordable education. We're burying young people under a mountain of student debt, so creating a path to the American dream for young people is a huge challenge because higher education and job training has become so unaffordable. Bringing high-speed internet everywhere There are so many dead spots in Wisconsin. How do you fully participate in a global economy or even fully participate in modern American life if you don't have access to that 21st century tool? And an awful lot of people, especially in rural areas, but also even in inner city neighborhoods, don't have access to high-speed internet. So those are the kinds of investments we can make to empower regular people to be able to thrive.
How do you differentiate yourself from the other candidates?
I think the thing that makes me stand apart more than anybody is just the life's work I've done seeking to expose corruption and big money influence in politics. But then I take that into the campaign. I'm the only candidate who refuses to take these huge donations that I think amount to legal bribes. Individuals can give up to $20,000 to a candidate for governor. Political action committees of special interest groups can give $86,000 to a candidate. But the work I've done almost my entire adult life has shown me the strings that are attached to those checks and the expectations that accompany those donations. And the other thing I've found over all these years is what the tiny segment of society that makes those huge donations want our government to do is vastly different from what regular people want our government to do. And they get their way on issue after issue. Everything that we care about, they're getting government to act according to their wishes instead of the needs of regular people in Wisconsin.
In what areas do you think you are vulnerable?
You know, we don't have the big money in our campaign, but I think when it comes to grassroots organization, we've got the richest campaign in the race. We've got over 2,500 volunteers now working all across the state of Wisconsin to reach out to voters, neighbors talking to neighbors, people knocking on doors, holding banners and big signs on busy intersections and freeway overpasses. So we don't have the big money, and we don't have a campaign that can run the way that the conventional playbook says you have to run a campaign. But again, when it comes to people power, I think we've got the richest campaign out there, and our job is to overcome money power with people power.
Mike McCabe is the founder of Blue Jean Nation and one of the people vying to be Wisconsin's Democratic candidate for governor.
We turn now to candidate Malin Mitchell. He's the president of the Wisconsin Firefighters Union, and he ran for lieutenant governor in 2012. Malin says if elected governor, he'll push for universal health care in Wisconsin.
Marty met up with him at a campaign stop in Milwaukee.
I'm running for governor because we need a change in our state. Governor Walker's had 8 years to divide and conquer us, and he's done that. He's had 8 years to tear the state apart, and he's done that. And we need a governor who is going to actually take care of people and put people over politics, people over bad policy, and even people over party at times. Majority of my life, I've been a firefighter for 20-plus years, and my job is to help others. And as firefighters, we respond to people on the worst days of their lives, and when people are at their worst, we have to be at our best. So we need a governor that actually takes care of people, so that's why I'm running. We need a change in our state.
What are the top three issues facing Wisconsinites, and how do you plan to address them?
Top three issues, I would say education is one of the top. We have an educational system that is lacking, and a lot of that is because of the 7.5 years of Scott Walker's cuts that have hurt public education. You can't take $1.6 billion from your first budget and then put back $630 million and now call yourself an educational governor, like our governor is. So we have a governor that has really, really hurt education. We need to do everything in our power to take care of our future, which is our children. I have two kids. I have a daughter that's a sophomore at UW Oshkosh, and I have a son who's a freshman in high school. And that's our future. And we have to take care of that. So I have a plan that we would actually require the state to pay two-thirds of the budget of each school district in our state, and that will help alleviate a lot of the pressure that school districts are facing. Because right now, when a place like Solon Springs, for instance, they had to have a referendum just to keep the lights on. Not for capital costs, but just to keep the lights on. And that's no way for us to be taking care of our school system. So we need to do everything in our power to make sure we take care of our future. And we do that not just by throwing money, but actually adequately staffing schools, making teachers feel good about teaching again. We need to make sure teachers get a raise all across the board. And those are some of the best people that I know, teachers. And we need to take care of teachers as well as our school district, because That's what's going to make Wisconsin thrive. The others are, you know, we have 300,000 people in the state of Wisconsin that have no health care whatsoever. We didn't take the federal dollars for the Medicaid expansion, and that's unfortunate. That's actually horrible, because that would put another 84,000 folks under, would have had health care. But health care, we need to make sure everyone has health care. That's why I've come out for Badger Care for All, and making sure everyone has health care. If we can give $4.5 billion to Foxconn, we can definitely make sure we have a great educational system and make sure we take care of everyone when it comes to health care. My mother's a diabetic. There should never be a time where a senior has to choose between paying their prescription drugs and getting those filled or paying their rent or their mortgage. There should never be a time a child can't go to the hospital because their parents can't afford it. So I will tell you, I healthcare is near and dear to my heart, and I will make sure as governor that every person in the state has not just healthcare, but also the access to healthcare that everyone needs, because you go to rural areas and there are people that can't get to an OBGYN appointment, for instance. There are people that can't get the medication that they need, so a lot of people just forego it. Well, that's not, doesn't help us as a state. It doesn't help Wisconsinites lead a healthy life. So healthcare is another one. Our economy, our governor will talk about us having a 2.8% unemployment rate. That's all well and good, but you come to certain communities of color, the unemployment rate is a lot higher. And you go around the state, people are working two or three jobs just to make ends meet. And that's no way to govern. You know, we'll never solve any of the problems, the school-to-prison pipeline, the achievement gap, having the highest African-American male incarceration rate, until we actually bring opportunities to communities that need them. And I was just in Rhinelander, I was in Superior, I was in Merrill, Hudson as well, and there's a lot of poverty out there as well. So this current economy is working well for those at the top, which it always does, but it's not working well for everyone in our state, and I want to make sure and work like hell that and make sure that we have everyone have a good job and a family-supporting job. And all these things are great to talk about, and you asked me the top three, but the number one thing really is I want to bring our state back together. And our state is so polarized right now, and everyone's talking at each other. And there's a lot of noise, but there's not a lot of things getting done. As a firefighter, my job is to get things done. We put the wet stuff on the hot stuff. No matter conditions change, construction changes, technology changes, at the end of the day, we put the wet stuff on the hot stuff. And we have to get back to a government that works for everybody, and get a governor in there, governor in the executive branch that's going to lead on the multitude of issues we have, and also bring the state back together.
How do you differentiate yourself from the other candidates?
Well, you know, I'm a firefighter by trade. I haven't run for office the majority of my life. I ran for lieutenant governor in 2012, where I got over 1.1 million votes, so we're building upon that. But, you know, we live in a state where we have, this is the worst place to raise black children in the country, and that doesn't escape me. And I'm a firefighter, so we, as a job, respond to our community, and we need a governor that cares about people. That should be the number one priority, is caring about all Wisconsinites here in our state, whether you're a Democrat or Republican. And you can only do that if you have, in my body of work and what I've done for the last 20 years, is respond to emergencies, respond to my community in emergency. And I believe here in the state that we're in an emergency as well. And it's an emergency to get things done for all people. So as governor, I will be a governor of action, a governor that will actually take care of all people and all the Wisconsinites here in our state. So I think what differentiates me is I don't pander to just people I'm in front of. I don't pander to certain audiences. I tell like it is, and I tell it straight. And I believe that differentiates me from a lot of the other, some of the other candidates as well.
In what areas do you think you are vulnerable?
None. Just kidding. You know, a lot of people will say that he does not have the experience, has not been part of the bureaucracy as long as others. But I'll tell you, I think we have enough political pundits. I think we have enough lifetime politicians in office, and I think that's part of the problem.
Malin Mitchell is the president of the Wisconsin Firefighters Union and one of the candidates vying to be the Democratic candidate for governor. Mitchell spoke with Marty Michelson.
We'll continue our look at the Democratic gubernatorial hopefuls the rest of this week. To see a full profile of each of the candidates, you can head to WUWM.com.
We'll take a short break and then return with Fit for You, our regular series of conversations on health and wellness. Lake Effect continues right after this on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Food is, of course, one of the main pillars of health. But the kinds of food we eat can cancel out all the positive effects of other healthy habits, like getting enough exercise and sleep. There is a lot of conflicting information about what is good for you and how you should determine the best diet for your particular circumstances.
Christy Linebaugh and Miriam Vigoa owned a restaurant together in Florida. Miriam's family's seasoned olive oil recipe quickly became a bestseller. And now the women travel the country helping others eat well and feel better using that olive oil. On this episode of Fit for You, they explain to Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski how they became healthy food advocates through olive oil.
So the craziest thing is we started off as a coffee house, and within a few months people were like, why aren't we eating here? It's very inconvenient. Just have coffee. We want to eat here as well. And so I told Miriam, oh my God, I don't know how to cook. What are we going to do? All these people want to eat here. And she said, well, I'll make my seasoned olive oil. If you just splash it on everything, people will think you know how to cook. And I'm like, perfect. And so that's what we started doing. So I just started literally making very tiny little sandwiches and putting her seasoned olive oil on it. And everybody went so crazy over it, they started asking her to bottle it. And she was like, no, we have the restaurant. And so she started bottling it. We actually went on to win 13 People's Choice Awards using her seasoned olive oil. So I would tell everybody I can't cook, but I splash. And that's what we always called it, was splash. And so our whole restaurant was literally based on the idea of shake, splash, and eat. And so all the seasonings, herbs, and spices are in the bottle. And so we did that for over 20 years. And it's funny because people will say, well, why'd you leave the restaurant? Well, the restaurant left us. It was destroyed by a flood. So.
Oh, no. Okay. So it was an easy decision.
Yeah.
Well, decision made for you.
That's right. So we tell everybody we didn't go out with a bang. We went out with a splash.
Okay.
So we said, well, we'll go full-time selling our seasoned olive oils. And everybody would say, why do we feel so good when we eat here and we feel so horrible when we eat at other places?
So your restaurant was healthy, focused, health-centric.
Yeah, definitely.
Actually, our customers, they would bring in bottles, empty bottles, and have us send some at home for the salads and so forth. The bottles became bigger and bigger, and it was them who finally talked me into researching and bottling it. And
so how did you first come to make olive oils? Was it a family recipe and tradition?
Yeah,
the
Canary Islands is where my family is from, and the original recipe was from my great-grandmother, and then it was given down to, this is our fourth generation, that we used to make it at home and for special occasions. But in my case, I started making it for the restaurant. I've always been a health advocate. I enjoy the clean eating. I've always have. And so I created something that would substitute the sodiums and the artificial ingredients and the GMOs. If you notice, our product is very simple, very clean, and it helps. It gives you the flavor besides the benefits.
Well, and I imagine owning a restaurant, you do have some control over what food you serve, what ingredients you serve. Was there also a problem with finding food distributors that didn't serve, quote, real food?
Absolutely.
That you had difficulties tracking down just simple food?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And, we would go to these food expos, food shows, and they would give us the samples. And the first thing I would do is look at the ingredients. And I looked at Christy and I said, oh, my gosh, it's 5,000 milligrams of sodium by the time you eat a cup and a half.
Mm-hmm.
So that really motivated me to initially create the olive oil. I changed a little bit from the original recipe so that it would serve the people that had high blood pressure or diabetes or heart issues. And then much later on, this is 22 years ago, when we didn't talk about inflammation, we didn't talk about the side effects that it could lead us to. We started something that had no idea what path it would take us, but here we are.
Yeah, it was funny because when we first opened, Miriam was like, don't tell people the food is healthy because they won't want to eat here, you know? And it was true. So I would tell people that, you know, we never really focused on the health benefits as far as like blatantly telling people. It was just that they continued to say, oh, we feel so good when we eat here. We feel so good, you know? And so we really didn't even promote that it was a healthy ingredient. We just would tell people it's the splash, you know?
Well, on that note, do you think that American food culture in particular, we don't put enough emphasis on into really paying attention into how we feel, say, before, during, after we eat, or paying attention to what's in our ingredients? You know, you don't want to drive customers away by saying we're a healthy restaurant,
right?
Because of whether we like it or not, that is not what people go out for.
Absolutely.
You know?
And that's really the thing, is that we really started focusing on, I actually have lost 50 pounds using it. And so what we always tell people is that, you know, maybe you're not necessarily fat, overweight. Maybe there's a lot of inflammation there, you know? And so it's like you start getting rid of the chemicals and you're realizing, oh, I really wasn't eating a ton to be so overweight. I was actually having inflammation from all the sodium and the sugar and the MSG and the GMOs. And so that was our main focus, is, you know, how do you feel when you eat? Is it like swallowing the devil because now you've got so much acid reflux that you're on fire? You know, have you eaten out and you're like, oh, I feel good for 5 minutes and then you feel horrible and you know, or you're sick the rest of the night. You know, we would hear people say that, well, you know, the next morning I can't get my rings off, you know, because that really, you can get over 3,000 milligrams of sodium at some of the restaurants. We talk about that in our book, too, is that you don't realize, because you would never use that much sodium at home, you know, so there's no way people can even comprehend how much chemicals and sugar and salt are in the food.
Right, so even if people are conscious to not, say, add extra salt shakers, you know, doing that to their food, if they say, oh, I've cut back so much, is that really the case? Because we don't pay close attention.
Absolutely. And I think, too, because it's not reality. Like, at home, if you're going to salt something, as far as, like, just a little shakes here and there, people don't realize, you know, we talk about in the book, too, that sliced turkey, you think you're being healthy, and you go out and you're like, oh, I'm going to get a turkey, sliced turkey sandwich. You know, and some of the, depending on the brands, you can get as much sodium as Spam. You know, and you're thinking, oh, my God, well, I'm having sliced turkey. I'm eating healthy. But the problem is, it's the fillers and everything, that you actually get less protein in deli turkey than you do real turkey because there's so many fillers. And I think that's where we're not comprehending, because it looks like turkey, you know, tastes like turkey.
So where do you think, with your experience running a restaurant, knowing where your food comes from, and then yourself adapting how you eat, do you think that, especially if you notice, Miriam, a difference in food culture and where our food comes from the Canary Islands versus here, is the American food system setting people up to fail?
You know, that is always going to be around, that food culture that we are calling it. So basically, I think that for the majority of the people, they are so enthralled in the now that they're not really paying attention on the health benefits that they could achieve if they would change their diet. I think that a lot of times we go out to eat, and it reminds them of how grandmother would make a gravy or a turkey, but they don't realize that that is all manufactured, is food technology.
In your book, you mention a note that intrigued me. There's the real food, the food, and the food product.
Yeah.
Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, there's, that's what we talked about in Kraft macaroni, or, you know, different products that they were literally not able to say that it was a food. They had to call it, you know, the cheese product, because the, there's such a small amount of food in there versus, you know, they call it cheese food instead of cheese, because there has to be a certain amount of actual food in there to be classified as food. And I think that's what happens, is we all start thinking of, well, these cheese slices are $1.99. Why would I pay $5 for these other cheese slices. And so we've been kind of trained to look at the prices, well, because everybody wants to save money, but we're not thinking, well, there's got to be, why is there such a big difference? You know, not thinking of, oh, it's because it's not actually even food.
What are some other basic tips that you would give to people who say they want to take the first step in maybe paying attention a little more to what they're eating? You know, what are some friendly first steps to do versus doing the extreme of I need to go on a complete cleanse or, you know, things that maybe set people back a little more than is helpful?
Right. I think a diary, a food diary, let's say for the first 3 days, for the first 4 days, you write down everything that you're eating and what reactions your body is taking. And personally, I follow the blood type diet. It's a biological diet, and it's worked for me.
Yeah,
so.
What I like to do also is, because I really wasn't on board in the very beginning of, because Miriam had been very much into eating healthy her whole life, and I really wasn't on board as far as that goes as much as she was. And so the fact that it was extremely simple, and so with the shake, splash, and eat, you know, shockingly simple recipes is really how we started doing it at the restaurant, is because it took the fear out of it. And I think that's a huge thing, is because you start talking about changing the way somebody eats, the way that somebody's done something their entire life, their fear comes in of, I don't know how to do it, I don't have time to do it, where am I going to get this special food, where do I have to shop? And so,
you know, what we haven't talked about is the celiacs, the wheat, the genetically modified. That has taken a lot of people's attention, and you know, this is the first step they take to eliminate all the whites, simple carbs. That sometimes that's the initiative, but they immediately start feeling better.
Do you feel that a lot of people are misdiagnosed with things like irritable bowel syndrome, or you know, maybe they think they're gluten intolerant when in fact it's a multitude of other foods they're consuming?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
So the simplest way, what I would do in the beginning, stay away from all the whites, all the sugars and the sodium and the wheat, anything that is genetically modified that you know of. And if you don't know it, look it up. You know, you have to do your research. And within 2 weeks, you immediately will see the change. Change in vitality, change in relief of pain. And actually, your joints, they're not swollen anymore. You can take your rings off after the next day.
I think, too, what happens is that because we are so rushed in today's society, you know, many people are working more than one job and taking care of children and sports and animals, and we want things as easy and fast as possible. And so we go to the marinades and all the dressings and all the flavorings. And so we say, well, I'm going to cook at home real quick and I'm just going to grab this bottle of, well, you know, maybe now you've started off with this beautiful piece of chicken and these fresh vegetables. Now you've just dumped, you know, pre-made dressings and stuff that were made with soybean oil and cottonseed oil and canola oil, which cause inflammation. So you start with that oil, and then you start adding MSG and sugar and salt, and it's like, oh my gosh, it's like this, you know, inflammation bomb goes off. And a lot of people are like, well, like what you were saying before, I don't use salt at home, and I don't use MSG. And I'm like, well, you don't really have to, because it's already in there.
So you guys went from both sides of prepping food, owning a restaurant, and then you yourself, Christy, having, you know, your own food transformation and health and weight loss. You know, what did you find the most satisfying in your roles in the restaurant career? And then what do you find the most satisfying now as traveling chefs and real food advocates?
Well, on the road, we get to meet a lot of people that are suffering. They're suffering from diabetes. They're suffering from high blood pressure. And that to us, you know, knowing what we know and knowing all the people that have shared with us, most of the times, is the digestive system that is totally, it's like an epidemic. I'm not really sure what word I want to use, but I want to serve them some of the knowledge that we have learned, and that we know it works. And so that's much different than being at the restaurant. at the restaurant. My job was in the back sometimes. We both traded because we did different venues and different activities. So, you know, we each had different times that we were cooking. That we wanted to give our customers the very, very best. They knew that everything that they were eating, it was just about love. It was a farm-to-table restaurant. So we knew the person that, you know, the eggs came from, this chicken, and they even had names.
Yeah.
We knew the arugula guy, you know, that sort of thing. And it was wonderful. I mean, the restaurant business is very hard. It was challenging, but it was satisfactory because our customers, but the community, total community, supported us and relied on us.
Yeah, one of our customers says, that darn olive oil, why you guys have to travel all over the country? And then Miriam's like, well, it's y'all's fault because you're the ones who talked me into bottling it. Mm-hmm. Now we got to go see everybody. But I would say, yeah, the restaurant, really, that was really the main thing of the community, the people, you know, children growing up there and coming in and knowing that they could eat healthy. So many kids have health issues now, allergies and things like that, and they always knew they could come there and we would cater to everything that they needed. So that was a different feel, a different kind of love, like what you were talking about, and Miriam. And now when we're on the road, you know, we talk to thousands and thousands of people, and across the board, it's like what Miriam was saying. There's so many people are confused. They're in pain. They're uncomfortable. They're trying to eat a little healthier. They're trying to feel better. And they just need it to be simple. And that's the biggest thing. It has to be easy. We're not going to do it if it's not easy. And so to be able to share it with people and see people's face light up of knowing that we can actually relate to where they're coming from, I think that just talking to so many people and giving them clarity is really a different kind of love, you know.
Well, Christy and Miriam, I want to thank you both so much for taking the time to visit me in the studio today.
Thank you for having us. We appreciate you.
Christy Linebaugh and Miriam Vigoa are the founders of Vigoa Cuisine and Olive Oils. You can find them in the Expo Center at the State Fair through August 12th.
Coming up, a short history of cats. No, not the musical, but the actual creatures themselves. You are listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Progress is not always linear, and that has certainly been the case for house cats. While their popularity has wavered over the centuries, cats have been an integral part of human history for millennia.
Dr. Paul Koudinaris is, among other things, a cat historian. And in honor of International Cat Day today, Koudinaris will be giving a lecture about the history of American cats at Cafe Lulu.
He sat down with me, and he starts by explaining our cultural perceptions of cats.
We think of them only in modern terms, and we tend to overlook how nasty humanity was to them at one point in time. You know, we're all familiar that with ancient Egypt being kind of like the zenith of feline culture, but we kind of overlook the fact that for several centuries during the Middle Ages, they were persecuted and not liked, and they were burned in bonfires, and they were considered the consorts of witches and the embodiment of the devil. You know, so it's like they were domesticated. They were raised to the highest of the highs, and they were plunged down to the lowest of the lows. And then very, very slowly, by the end of the 19th century, they finally built themselves up to be companions again. Because if you went back in time to like 1850, they would have been considered, even though they were living in a city environment, they'd be considered no better than like a weasel or a raccoon. In terms of the domestication, you know, I always say that we make a big mistake when we think we domesticated animals. It's a partnership, and it always is. And anyone who doesn't believe me, go out and get yourself a bobcat and give it a try and see what happens. You know, back in the days, humans thought they were so crafty, and they came up with this thing called agriculture back in the Neolithic. And they didn't have the foresight to realize that this was heaven for rats and mice, because all this excess that could be stored was free food for them, and they had no ability to combat them. And slowly, the one specific type of cat, which was the North African wildcat, Slowly, those guys started to figure it out, and they look a lot like a modern tabby would. And they kind of came along and said, hey, all those mice we want to kill, they're all right here. This is a, let's hang out on the outskirts, you know? And then over time, you know, humanity was afraid of them at first. They didn't like them. It would be about the same as having bobcats hanging out. And over time, they realized we need these guys. And so, like I say, it was a partnership because they got something from us and we got something from them. And we probably needed them more than they needed us at first. When they would kill all those rats, eventually humanity would go out and leave them scraps of food to be like, hey, guys, don't leave. Don't leave because we know what happens when you leave. And eventually, you know, eventually that magic moment occurred somewhere back in the Middle East where some guy stretches out his hand and some cat puts his head up and that first pet is made. But it's a partnership with them, and it always has been. And a lot of people will tell you it's like it's more than just a partnership. My cat's actually in charge.
It's funny because when you go back to, you know, you talked about the changes in how we view cats. When you go back to specifically the plague,
yeah.
in England, you know, they killed all the dogs, they killed all the cats,
yeah.
And it just caused the plague to, you know, bloom because they were no longer killing these rats.
Well, I have a statistic for you, actually, on that. That is nauseating probably for a lot of people to hear. First of all, controlling rats. And originally in Europe, it was the brown rat, which wasn't as bad as the black rat, but the black rat came back with the Crusaders. Controlling rats, in considering, you know, medieval sanitation and the kind of way they were living, a lot of people were living in like what we would consider like a beaver lodge or something practically, that was heaven for rats. And it was hard enough to control them even with a healthy feline population. But once you start not only decimating them but chasing them away from your habitations, those rats are going to breed and breed and breed. Something like a pair of black rats can within 3 years breed something like a million others. And on the average in the Middle Ages, there were 10 rats per household. So humans were outnumbered by rats in their own household. And like I said, it would have been hard enough to control them even with a healthy feline population. Without that, those people were doomed. And they did get their comeuppance for that war against cats. They got their comeuppance by realizing, like I said, go back to the beginning. We needed them at the start more than they needed us, and it turned out we really did still need them at some point in time.
So when did we, specifically here in America, where for a long time cats were, again, not terribly welcome, when did we go from these are street animals, these are unwanted, to let's bring them in?
America has an interesting relationship with cats. I like to say, and this is why the talk I'm doing in Milwaukee is specifically about the history of American cats, because it's a fascinating topic, because there is no country in the world where the history of the people and the history of the cats is so closely tied, so closely unified. You know, America was founded by these outcasts who came from Europe. But they came on those boats with cats because cats were needed to kill rats and mice on those ships. We don't, you know, we look at the Mayflower and all those ships as bringing human colonists, but we don't realize they brought feline colonists too because it was a one-way trip. So those cats also got off those boats at the same time as those people, and they founded their own feline states of America, you know? And Europe was still persecuting cats, but there was something about American ingenuity that was more about like, we want to know what value things have, you know, more than really the spiritual detriment of having a cat around, you know. And so America was more interested in trying to find ways to put them to work. You know, there's this old theory in England that Isaac Newton invented the cat door, as if it takes, you know, a genius in astrophysics in order to figure out a cat door. It's not true. You know who invented it? American farmers. Because they didn't really want them as pets yet, but at the same time, they knew these guys can help us. So they made these little doors so the cats could go in and out, even wild cats could go in and out and kill rats. America was the first country in the world to write cats into its national budget. In the 19th century, the Treasury Department wrote cats into the budget to protect the mail. The first budget involving cats included $1,000 for the U.S. Postal Service, $100 to New York, $10 to Philadelphia, and so on down the line, depending on the size of the post office. And it doesn't sound like a lot of money, but remember, these cats were supposed to be feeding themselves. But if the cats would kill all those mice, they'd be like, yeah, we want to feed these guys. These are government employees. The United States Army, people don't know this, we think of, you know, war dogs, right? The United States Army had hired cats long before they had hired dogs. The United States Army had hired cats in the 19th century, again, to protect the commissaries. And every commissary had cats. We did not have a dog service in the United States Army until World War I. So, the United States embraced cats more than any other country. They finally really, but they're not really pets. Like I say, they're more like service animals. It's something that comes in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. Interestingly, again, the parallel between American people and American cats, it was in the West where the cats made their name. It wasn't back in the East, because we expect, you know, American culture to flow east to west. A lot of cats had wound up going out west, and people don't realize that a lot of cowboys had cats too, and some of them would even ride with them on their saddle, you know, because they wanted to protect their rations from field mice when they would stay somewhere for the night, because, you know, this guy's going out for 3 months at a time. He can't afford to lose his rations, so he might bring a cat along with him. And think for a second about, you know, some cowboy, lonesome guy on the trail, all he's got is this cat. You know he's going to become friends with that damn animal because they're good animals and they're nice animals. And so they started becoming accepted more in the West, and then that filters back to the East. And once it starts filtering back to the East, it gets picked up by the avant-garde, you know, the independent thinkers, guys like Mark Twain. He was one of the first great Americans to love cats. The writers all started loving cats. In a way, it was a way to kind of like flaunt social mores and take the anti-pet. I'm going to take the cat instead of a dog. But they'd also found something in them. The Americans, it was the Americans who realized, I think for the first time, something the ancients realized, that a cat is an enigma. And in being an enigma, it can be a muse. And so it was the American literati and all the artists, and these articles would come out in the newspaper that said, you know, it's like, hey, if you want to be a writer, get yourself a cat. And so it was around that time, it was around the late 19th, early 20th centuries, they really start being accepted in American culture. It starts with the aesthetes. It starts with the writers and the painters, and you know how that goes. You know, it's like, they're the bearers of culture. So once they start doing it, everybody else starts crashing the party.
So I know that you're researching a book, really, mm-hmm. about cats. What are some of the more interesting cats that you've come across as you've been doing the research, specific cats?
Yeah, there's some great ones. America, as I said, really has a great history in cats. In the 1890s, there was a cat in Chicago by the name of Toots Willard. And Toots Willard was the temperance cat. Toots Willard was the cat who saved America from public drunkenness. And Toots Willard was owned by a woman who was very big in the temperance movement. And she used to bring this cat around to temperance meetings. And Toots Willard was this enormous cat, like 30 pounds. So it was kind of like, it just worked because of its freak appeal. Like, they'd sell pictures of Toots Willard. It was kind of like nowadays if they sent, like, a 60-pound raccoon to a grammar school to tell kids to stay off of opioids or something. It was just like it had this weird freak appeal. So Toots Willard was this really big deal. And he raised thousands and thousands of dollars for the temperance movement in America. He was like the public face of the temperance movement. Our first celebrity cat was, you know, we think now, oh, well, it's the day of the cats because of the internet, you know. We don't realize how big some of these animals were and how famous they were in their day, because we remember human history and we don't tell it from, you know, the animal's perspective. There was a cat by the name of Kiddo, who was an airship cat, who was super famous because the first dirigible aircraft to ever try to cross the Atlantic crashed. For all the humans, there was humiliation, but it wasn't the cat's fault. So kind of like to put a spin on it, they're like, hey, aviating cat, and everybody went for it. And this cat went on a national tour in 1911. This cat, Kiddo, was making $2,000 a week. In 1911, when money meant something, that's a big deal cat. $2,000 a week in 1911. So we've had our share of really fascinating cats that people have forgotten. Another of America's first famous cats was the Brooklyn Borough Cat, a cat by the name of Jerry Fox, who was famous because he wore spectacles. When his eyes started to go bad, they had fit him with a tiny little pair of glasses and somehow gave him an eye test. So we've had this wonderful history of these very colorful animals. You know, there's something much more to a cat than sitting on a couch if you'll let it be something more.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing so much about cat history, so much that I didn't know. And thanks for joining us here in Milwaukee.
Thank you so much.
Paul Koudenaris is a cat historian who's in Milwaukee for a talk on the history of American cats. Proceeds will go to benefit the Wisconsin Humane Society. And for more information, you can go to WUWM.com.
Coming up next, Radio Chipstone talks about some of the ways in which information technology and museums could learn from one another. That's when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR.
We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Curiosity led Ellen Folletti to take a class in the Material Culture Department at UW-Madison. Folletti is a master's student in the Library and Information Program, but she says her interest in the stories objects tell led her to two semesters focusing on 19th century ceramics.
In this edition of Radio Chipstone, Folletti and contributor Jennifer Fields met at the Chazen Museum in Madison to discuss the importance of inclusion in both information technology and museum collections. The challenge is to find ways to break down barriers, real or imagined, and offer people a chance to discover their own stories that are reflected in once everyday objects now behind glass.
I think, especially in art museums, putting objects behind glass, it creates this idea of, like, I have to get this or understand something. Like, I'm afraid of what I think about it to be wrong, you know? For me, it was emphasizing this idea that these were everyday objects then, and like, how can we value our everyday objects now and see them, like, what is something that I own that I would consider museum worthy? And is that just what it is what we consider to be museum worthy? It's hard to make a connection to, like, see yourself in some of these objects when it feels so far away, when they're from the 19th century.
I have my father's stainless steel Stanley thermos that he carried to work for him for 30 years. That to me is as priceless as one of these things. And I think that that's the idea that I want people to sort of get into it. Just because someone else has determined this thing to be priceless does not mean that your thing that you have is worthless.
Right. At the beginning of the class, Anne had us bring in our favorite object that, like, we could carry liquids in. And I brought in a plastic cup, so something that's manufactured and, like, everyone has. But it was from my grandmother's. I remember going to her house and, like, drinking milk out of it and, like, watching TV with her. And, like, it's the memory behind it. And I think even though it's something that's, like, mass-produced and every child from the 90s probably had, like, that's as priceless as something that's in a museum. And I think that's something that I hope to, like, help people recognize, is that we don't need to feel that what we own or, like, the stories we have aren't worthy of being shared or told or, like, put in a museum somewhere.
Is that notion butting up against the traditional ideal of what a museum is? Are you finding, as you get more and more into your studies, there are things that you just don't agree with? How do you then go about reconciling that? How do you work through that?
I know in libraries and archives, we talk a lot about making sure that people feel welcomed and making sure that they can start seeing themselves in the stories that are told or in the collections that are held. And that's very encouraging. Sometimes it feels like it's more of the newer professionals that are into that idea. It's very easy to come across people who are just like, well, this is how it's always been, so this is how it will always be. And it's encouraging to see, like, my peers and my colleagues be more focused on who's not being represented or whose story can we amplify that hasn't been told before or is not as popular as what the mainstream is. But there's a long way to go, definitely. But I'm excited to be a part of that. And I think a part of that is also just knowing that I still have so much to learn. So once I graduate, that doesn't mean that I'm done learning, and that doesn't mean that I know everything. I think it's approaching communities, whatever community, it's approaching them saying, I can provide the basic tools, but you have the knowledge, that we can work together to make sure that items or memories are preserved and can last and how to amplify those stories. But we're learning from each other in that aspect, that we're both students, but we're both also the teachers in that.
Ellen, why is this important to you?
I've gone to museums and I see items and I feel like I'm not supposed to be here, or like going somewhere and seeing objects that I've read about in books or like seeing on the internet or something, like to actually be in those spaces, it's so easy to feel like I'm not supposed to be here, like I don't fit in. But I do belong there. Everyone belongs there. I mean, I think museums want to promote their collections, and there is importance to the histories behind them, but also I want to make sure that they're not continuing to isolate people or making other people feel isolated, and because I know how that feels and it's not a good feeling. I like want to break down that barrier of like elitism and that feeling of isolation, because I think we can do so much more once we involve more people. For me, it's on the institution, the museums, the libraries, to make sure that they're creating spaces that do feel welcoming.
Material culture contributor Jennifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
Fields' interview with Ellen Folletti, a UW-Madison master's student in the Library and Information Studies program, first aired in May. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh Air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.